one-man revolution, a guerrilla scholar warrior, a renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Carl Hess was an American national-level speechwriter and author. He was also a political philosopher, editor, welder, motorcycle racer, tax resister, atheist, and libertarian activist. His career included stints on the Republican right and the New Left before embracing free market anarchism. That is the first sentence in Carl Hess's entry in Wikipedia, and that, I hope, gives you a little glimpse into just how interesting this guy was. Now, before I proceed, I just want to mention my main sources here are Carl's own autobiography, Mostly on the Edge, which I believe is actually the second autobiography he wrote, and a smattering of other writings by Carl, some of which are also located in Mostly on the Edge, and also Brian Doherty's wonderful book, Radicals for Capitalism, a freewheeling history of the modern American libertarian movement, which, by the way, I highly recommend. It's a great book, well written. Contains a lot of good info on people you've heard of and probably people you hadn't heard of. I know there are some people in there I hadn't heard of until I read that book, and I consider myself kind of a libertarian slash anarchist buff. Now, Carl Hess was born Carl with a C, Hess the Third, in Washington, D.C. on May 25th, 1923. His father, Carl Hess Jr., was a very wealthy tennis champ of German and Spanish ancestry who came from the Philippines. I think he was also part Filipino, too. And he married Carl III's mother, Thelma, who was a photographer's assistant in Washington, D.C. When Carl was a baby, they relocated to the Philippines. But within a few years of the birth of Carl III, his mother, Thelma, left Carl Jr. because Carl Jr. was a ridiculously over-the-top, compulsive, serial philanderer. I mean, we're talking, you know, could give Tiger Woods a run for his money. And, oh my, holy crap, another part Filipino athlete. That's interesting. Anyway, I suppose that's just coincidence. Anyway, when Thelma left her husband, she brought young Carl, who I think was only a few years old at the time, back to D.C. So he basically grew up fatherless and in the Washington, D.C. area. Now, Thelma was apparently a highly intelligent, independent-minded woman. Why she married a serial philanderer in the first place, I don't know, other than it may have been a combination of good looks and riches that made her go against her own intelligence and marry him. But though highly intelligent and independent, she was a high school dropout. And perhaps because she was very intelligent but a high school dropout, she understood the difference between education and schooling. More on that in a second. After she divorced Carl Jr., Thelma did not take any alimony from him, even though he's a wealthy guy. She wanted to take care of herself and her son on her own. So she worked various jobs, including, among other things, being a switchboard operator. And she wanted to make sure her son was well-educated. But like I said a moment ago, Thelma understood that schooling and education are not necessarily or perhaps even frequently the same things. So Thelma taught Carl to read at a young age, and then not much after he learned to read, she taught him how to use a public library. And this is way back decades and decades and decades before even the early primitive proto-internet. So public library, card catalog system, all that stuff was the way to get information back then. And once young Carl could read and could use a public library, Thelma then began insisting that he try to teach himself and answer his own questions as much as humanly possible. She stopped giving him answers and instead encouraged him to find his own answers. And he got completely immersed in this teaching himself. Carl began skipping school with his mother's permission. I think she even, you know, covered for him in regards to the school authorities. The only a condition that his mother put on him skipping school, starting at a rather young age, was that he must be either at the library or at some place else where he's learning something. And Carl totally got into that with gusto. Carl officially dropped out of school at the ripe young age of 15 and immediately began looking for a job. He pretty quickly found one at a local radio station, and soon thereafter he began writing for various newspapers in sort of the D.C. Area and its suburbs. So this is a guy, not only does he not spend a day as a college student, he doesn't even make it through high school. In fact, when he's, I think, 15, to be roughly high school freshman or sophomore, he's done with school altogether, and he had been skipping it frequently for years prior to that. And yet, he's out on his own, making a career for himself in his teen years, when most of his contemporaries were spending most of their time in school, and if they had a job at all, it was flipping burgers for minimum wage. Carl, on the other hand, by the ripe age of 22, was a successful DC area journalist. And as a side note, I mean, how many people today already have a successful career going by age 22? Damn few. I know I sure as hell didn't. And I was ahead of the curve relative to others of my generation that I observed. I mean, I had a full-time college history teaching career, not exactly glamorous, but it's a living and it's a career, and it beats the hell out of throwing freight or flipping burgers. I had that going by about 26. So I was still behind Carl, even though I was ahead of most of my fellow Gen X / Yers, depending on where you draw the line. Anyway, by this time, early 20s, writing for newspapers, Carl started spelling his first name with a K, as you see it on the show notes, and as you will find it in Wikipedia and everywhere else. Started spelling his first name with a K instead of a C, and dropped the third, the Roman numeral 3, from his name officially altogether. And I'm sure in part he did that because he had no particular love or respect for his father, and that, first name with a C and having the third on there just reminded him of that. And he also, I think, said something along the lines of that Carl with a K just always looked stronger to him than Carl with a C. In the late 1940s, so when Carl was still in his, I guess, mid to late 20s, he began to get active in politics as a Republican and was drawn early on to what today we call the old right, meaning anti-war / anti-welfare state conservatives who were the main opponents of FDR, both his New Deal and then his movement towards war when World War II started. And as a side note, I'll probably do at least one episode, if not more, on the old right in the future. For now, let's just say there were these people who today, in hindsight, we look back and label as the old right. And I think Murray Rothbard might have come up with that label, by the way. These are sort of like proto-libertarians, although admittedly they're not always consistent. But in case you don't know, conservatives, quote-unquote, in the American political context were generally anti-imperialist and anti-militarist until sometime in about the early to mid-1950s when conservatives began to become the hawks that we know so well in more recent times. That's when a conservative started to be identified with a hardcore war hawk or warmonger as a label. Now, around this time that he started getting interested in politics, Carl began writing speeches. He had a knack for it. He had always been very into reading from very early in his age, very, very early in his life, obviously. And also, he had been writing, like from his late teens, he had been writing for newspapers. And he really had a literary knack. And you'll see this when I read some quotes and passages from him later on in the podcast. So he got on as a speechwriter for various politicians, mostly Republicans. He was heavily involved with Governor Thomas Dewey's campaign for president against Harry Truman in 1948. This is, of course, the one where all the polls and indicators said that Dewey was going to beat Truman, and Truman ended up staging one of the biggest surprises in American history, won the election. There's the famous photo of Harry Truman himself holding up the newspaper saying Dewey Beach Truman, which had been printed before all the votes were cast, and yeah. In 1950, Carl Hess became an editor at Newsweek magazine, where he stayed for several years. During this time period, he was continued to be involved in what might be considered then and now kind of far-right activities. He was personally involved in a failed attempt to overthrow the government of Cuba, which was then ruled by Fulgencio Batista. This is pre-Castro's revolution. Batista was the United States' sock puppet military dictator in Cuba for a bunch of years. And as far as I've been able to tell, this particular attempt to overthrow the government of Cuba was actually to overthrow it from the right. In other words, a government that would be to the right of Batista, although I haven't been able to dig up all the details on this. At least not, you know, with any degree of accuracy as far as the ideology of who the heck was trying to take over in Cuba that Hess was involved with. But apparently, his activities even included running guns into Cuba. Now, the United States government ultimately squashed the coup, or the attempted overthrow, or whatever the hell you want to call it. And some people were prosecuted for this, but Hess was among some who were not prosecuted for their involvement in this. Now, at the time, so we're talking, you know, early to mid-50s, Hess seemed like a rather conventional right-winger, and largely because of his very staunch anti-communism. This was the reason why, at the time, you started to get the, when you really study it, strange bedfellow alliance of libertarians and sort of proto-fascists that today we call conservatives. At the time, in the really, you know, most tense early days of the Cold War, it seemed to make sense for social conservative types, what might be called, fascist light, to ally with more libertarian-minded people because they had a common enemy in communism. It's arguable whether that even made sense at the time, but even if it did, with the Cold War long since gone, conservatism has lost a lot of its coherence and relevance, whatever coherence and relevance it ever did have, from the 50s onward. So think of Carl Hess at this time as being sort of a John Birch Society Republican, if you know what that is, if you don't look it up. In fact, Hess's aggressive and public support, including in writing, of notorious Senator Joseph McCarthy, the communist witch hunter, actually cost him his job at Newsweek magazine in 1954. His people at Newsweek, though they, I think, were largely Republican, saw this as too far, too extreme. After losing his job at Newsweek, Carl freelanced for several years, did a lot of writing in various fields, including some writing in outdoors magazines, hunting and fishing stuff. He was always into that. He also worked for a while in public relations, I think in the late 50s, for a paper company, all the while continuing to write speeches and do things like ghostwrite columns for various politicians. In the early days of National Review magazine, William F. Buckley's magazine, which was really a major turning point in making American conservatism much more hawkish and militaristic, Hess was among those involved in kind of the early foundational period of National Review magazine. In 1960, Hess moved back to D.C. I think he'd been living in Maryland for much of the year since he, you know, moved out of his mom's house. He moved back to D.C. to take a job as a head writer for the Republican National Committee's platform, 1960 being election year, of course. Close election, if you don't know. John F. Kennedy defeated Richard Nixon by one of the narrowest margins in American history, and there's still some serious doubts about how much the election may or may not have been rigged or manipulated, etc. Won't get into that now for the sake of time. Next presidential election year, 1954, Carl Hess again had a job as one of the main writers of the Republican National Committee's platform, and this in turn led to him becoming a speechwriter for that year's Republican Party presidential nominee, the conservative senator from Arizona, Barry Goldwater. By the way, as a side note, I'm considering doing a podcast on Barry Goldwater in the future. I think he's very interesting and very important, very interesting character. I have more mixed feelings about him than I do about Hess. Hess, I'm much more positive Goldwater, I'm a little bit more conflicted. I think there's obviously an importance to the 1964 Goldwater campaign, though, as a seminal movement for a lot of what you might consider libertarians or freedom-minded people in the United States. And Goldwater himself had some clear libertarian tendencies on a lot of issues, though, of course, he wasn't a true libertarian as such, largely because he was still quite hawkish, and this prevented him from being a full-blown libertarian across the board. Well, as far as that 1964 campaign goes, long story short, the Republican Party establishment hated Goldwater, and they tried to prevent him from getting the presidential nomination that year. They tried to get their preferred candidate nominated, which was the arch-establishmentarian Nelson Rockefeller of the famous Rockefeller family dynasty. That Goldwater got the nomination at all in 64 was the result of a genuine grassroots revolt within the Republican Party. The establishment hated it. And as a result, when Goldwater managed to shock a lot of people and get the nomination, the Republican Party establishment basically disowned him and his campaign, didn't really support it, and in at least some ways tried to sabotage it. And that, combined with some other factors, a few campaign gaffes and so on, led Goldwater to go down in one of the biggest landslide losses in American history to the incumbent president, Democrat Lyndon Johnson, in 64. Around this time period, Carl divorced from his first wife and had what some of us might consider kind of a midlife crisis, although in many ways it never really ended for the rest of his life. So maybe it wasn't a midlife crisis. Maybe it was a genuine epiphany and change of course. He kind of quit his respectable jobs that he'd been doing, bought a motorcycle, became a welder, learned how to weld both for kind of industrial and also for artistic purposes. He later got into doing sculpture with welding and so on. But he became a genuine, you know, skilled artisan at welding. Got a hippie girlfriend who he eventually, I believe, married and began living on a houseboat. So, like, you know, your dad's midlife crisis, but, like, multiplied many times over. And around this time, he began sporting what Brian Doherty refers to as a Castro-esque beard and field jacket. He began having the appearance, not much different from the left-wing student radicals, the SDSers, and so on, of the time period. And not surprisingly, with all this change in lifestyle and appearance, he was by this time period basically done with the Republican Party. Not that they really wanted him anymore. Most people who were heavily involved in the Goldwater campaign were persona non grata after that campaign failed so badly in 64. Although, for the rest of his life, Hess remained friendly with Goldwater and still admired him, even when Hess had gone much more down the road towards radical politics and ultimately anti-politics. He still had mostly positive things to say about Goldwater. In the late 60s, Hess flirted with a few years for the ideological left, including a stint at the left-wing think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. Around this time, he also discovered the work of the anarcho-capitalist, libertarian, economist, philosopher, political scientist Murray Rothbard, whom he befriended for a while, although they later apparently had a bit of a falling out because Rothbard became disillusioned with the student radical movement, while Hess remained at least somewhat friendly to it. And during this time period, there's an interesting story Brian Doherty writes about in Radicals for Capitalism when writing about Hess. There was a young man named Doug Meinshausen, who was a young conservative Republican and a member of Bill Buckley's organization, Young Americans for Freedom, or YAF. And the House of Representatives had a committee at the time called the House Internal Security Committee that was very concerned about left-wing student radicals, SDS, and so on, including, by the way, sort of by association, Carl Hess. And so this committee, the House Internal Security Committee, gave this guy Don Meinhausen a job to kind of go spy on a lot of these student radicals. And in the process of this, Carl Hess actually converted Meinhausen to radical libertarianism and inspired him to publicly resign from spying for the House Internal Security Committee. I mean, talk about a coup of persuasion, charisma, whatever mix it was. Apparently, Carl Hess, from everybody who knew him, was one of these larger-than-life personalities, one of these just very charismatic and interesting guys. In 1969, Hess became a public tax protester and resistor, refusing to pay any income taxes to the federal government for principled reasons that he basically thought it was immoral. And this made his life very difficult from that point on, and he lived for another 2.5 decades. He was constantly in trouble with the government. He had to be very careful about what he did, how he lived his life. As Brian Doherty puts it, quote, "For the rest of his life, Hess was unable to earn any legal income or own property in his own name," end quote. Eventually, Hess seemed in some of his statements to at least partially regret his decision on pragmatic grounds because of the amount of trouble and hassle it caused to him and his family. Around the same time he was starting to get in trouble with the government over taxes, he wrote an essay that was published in March of 1969 in, of all places, Playboy magazine. And this became, I think, arguably Hess's most famous and influential work. And of course, I'm talking about an essay entitled The Death of Politics. And I'll try to remember to put a link to the full text of the essay in the show notes. It's been reprinted in a bunch of different places, including online. But I'm going to read you a few excerpts from this, just so you can get a sense of Carl Hess's literary skill, but also his attitudes and his way of looking at things. The Death of Politics. "This is not a time of radical, revolutionary politics. Not yet. Unrest, riot, dissent, and chaos notwithstanding, today's politics is reactionary. Both left and right are reactionary and authoritarian. That is to say, both are political. They seek only to revise current methods of acquiring and wielding political power. Radical and revolutionary movements seek not to revise, but to revoke. The target of revocation should be obvious. The target is politics itself. Radicals and revolutionaries have had their sights trained on politics for some time. As governments fail around the world, as more millions become aware that government never has and never can humanely and effectively manage men's affairs, government's own inadequacy will emerge at last as the basis for a truly radical and revolutionary movement. In the meantime, the radical revolutionary position is a lonely one. It is feared and hated by both right and left, although both right and left must borrow from it to survive. The radical revolutionary position is libertarianism, and its socioeconomic form is laissez-faire capitalism. Libertarianism is the view that each man is the absolute owner of his life to use and dispose of as he sees fit, that all man's social actions should be voluntary, and that respect for every other man's similar and equal ownership of life and by extension, the property and fruits of that life, is the ethical basis of a humane and open society. Laissez-faire capitalism, or anarcho-capitalism, is simply the economic form of the libertarian ethic. Laissez-faire capitalism encompasses the notion that men should exchange goods and services without regulation solely on the basis of value for value. It recognizes charity and communal enterprises as voluntary versions of this same ethic. Such a system would be straight barter, except for the widely felt need for a division of labor in which men voluntarily accept value tokens such as cash and credit. Economically, this system is anarchy, and proudly so. Libertarianism is rejected by the modern left, which preaches individualism but practices collectivism. Capitalism is rejected by the modern right wing, which preaches enterprise but practices protectionism. The libertarian faith in the mind of men is rejected by religionists who have faith only in the sins of man. The libertarian insistence that men be free to spin cables of steel as well as dreams of smoke is rejected by hippies who adore nature but spurn creation. The libertarian insistence that each man is a sovereign land of liberty with his primary allegiance to himself is rejected by patriots who sing of freedom but also shout of banners and boundaries. There is no operating movement in the world today that is based upon a libertarian philosophy. If there were, it would be in the anomalous position of using political power to abolish political power. Political parties and politicians today, all parties and all politicians, question only the forms through which they express, through which they will express their common belief in controlling the lives of others. Power, particularly majoritarian or collective power, i.e. the power of an elite exercised in the name of the masses, is the god of the modern liberal. Its only recent innovative changes to suggest that the elite be leavened by the compulsory membership of authentic representatives of the masses. The current phrase is participatory democracy. Just as power is the god of the modern liberal, God remains the authority of the modern conservative. Liberalism practices regimentation by simply regimentation. Conservatism practices regimentation by, not quite so simply, revelation. But regimented or revealed, the name of the game is still politics. And understand, I'm skipping over large passages because this is a rather long essay. It is technology that makes it feasible to contemplate a day in which the politics of nationhood will be as dead as the politics of power-wielding partisanship. First, there is enough information and wealth available to ensure the feeding of all people without the slaughtering of some to get at the possessions of others. Second, there is no longer any way to protect anything or anybody behind a national border anyway. It is to be expected that both liberals and conservatives respond to the notion of the end of nationhood with very similar shouts of outrage or jerks of reaction. The conservative says, "It shall not be. There will always be a U.S. Customs inspector, and long may he wave." The liberal says that far from ending nationhood, he wants to expand it, make it worldwide, to create a proliferation of mini and micro nations in the name of ethnic and cultural preservation, and then to erect a great super bureaucracy to supervise all the petty bureaucracies. Obviously, talking about the United Nations and things along those lines. Continuing. Like Linus, neither liberal nor conservative can bear the thought of giving up the blanket, of giving up government and going it alone as residents of a planet rather than a country. As long as there are governments powerful enough to maintain national boundaries and national political postures, then there will be the absolute risk, if not the certainty, of war between them. Even the possibility of war seems far too cataclysmic to contemplate in a world so ripe with technology and prosperous potential, ripe even with the seeds of extraterrestrial exploration. Violence in the institutions that alone can support it should be rendered obsolete. And then this is the closing of the essay, and again, I've skipped large passages for the sake of time and brevity. You don't want to listen to me read this whole thing. You read it for yourself if you're so inclined, and I hope you will. This is the last few paragraphs of the essay. Power and authority, as substitutes for performance and rational thought, are the specters that haunt the world today. They are the ghosts of awed and superstitious yesterdays, and politics is their familiar. Politics, throughout time, has been an institutionalized denial of man's ability to survive through the exclusive employment of all his own powers for his own welfare. And politics throughout time has existed solely through the resources that it has been able to plunder from the creative and productive people whom it has, in the name of many causes and moralities, denied the exclusive employment of all their own powers for their own welfare. Ultimately, this must mean that politics denies the rational nature of man. Ultimately, it means that politics is just another form of residual magic in our culture, a belief that somehow things come from nothing. That things may be given to some without first taking them from others. That all the tools of man's survival are his by accident or divine right, and not by pure and simple inventiveness and work. politics has always been the institutionalized and established way in which some men have exercised the power to live off the output of other men. But even in a world made docile to these demands, men do not need to live by devouring other men. Politics does devour men. A laissez-faire world would liberate men, and it is in that sort of liberation that the most profound revolution of all may be just beginning to stir. It will not happen overnight, just as the lamps of rationalism were not quickly lighted and have not yet burned brightly. But it will happen, because it must happen. Man can survive in an inclement universe only through the use of his mind. His thumbs, his nails, his muscles, and his mysticism will not be enough to keep him alive without it. To me, it's simply incredible that nearly a half century ago, Playboy magazine, of all places, published something simultaneously so intelligent and so radical as Carl Hess's essay, The Death of Politics. The type of thing that most mainstream, serious, intelligent magazines wouldn't do then or now. And yet, there it was, all the way back in 1969. Getting back to Carl Hess's own life story, in the mid-1970s, Hess became an outspoken activist on behalf of what you might call localism and community self-sufficiency, decentralism, that kind of stuff, a movement that flowered for much of the 70s and seems to be having a resurgence in recent years. For about 5 years in the 70s, Carl and his second wife, to whom he remained married for the rest of his life, a woman named Therese, tried to run self-sufficiency projects, community-oriented projects in inner-city Washington, D.C. with mixed results. They included things like machine shops where people could learn to make stuff, along with hydroponic gardening and even aquaculture. I think they were raising like rainbow trout or something in some warehouses in inner-city Washington, D.C. But they ran into some problems getting along in the neighborhood. Not everybody in the neighborhood was really into what they were trying to do, and ultimately it didn't quite work out. After about 5 years, they gave up on it and moved out of D.C. to rural West Virginia, where they built a solar-powered home, actually like an underground, almost hobbit house type of a thing, into a hillside in West Virginia. I think it was either mostly or entirely off-grid, to use today's lingo. So he was, again, ahead of his time, as he was in so many other things throughout his life. There he was, kind of being a prepper type without really realizing that's what he was doing or using those terms for the most part. But he just had this idea that decentralism and self-sufficiency were good things and liberating things and empowering things to pursue. And Carl lived in this little self-made underground hillside home for the rest of his life. And by this time, you can see in his writings and his statements that he's as much about anti-corporatism as he is about anti-statism. And he saw, as I do and others do as well, that being anti-state and anti-corporate is entirely consistent, since corporations are creations of the state, and the state is, of course, the ultimate corporation, the biggest corporation, the baddest corporation, the one ring to rule the other ring, so to speak. In his second autobiography, which is the one that I've read, entitled Mostly on the Edge, Carl writes in response to controversy among libertarians, and I think he actually meant like literal Libertarian Party people, and he was involved with the party for a while, that there was a controversy over whether or not he was himself a capitalist. And in response to this, Carl wrote, quote, "I wrote that I am by occupation a free marketer. As a frequent barterer, I am a capitalist of the laissez-faire persuasion. I am not a defender of state corporate capitalism, the capitalism of the two large political parties. Nor do I hold that capitalism is the only way in which a free market may be maintained. There are other sorts of agreements about property and ownership and money which, if made and maintained voluntarily," parentheses, I think that's a key phrase, a key word there, voluntarily, if made and maintained voluntarily, seem to me to be libertarian. I am, to give a shorthand summary of it all, a free market pluralist," end quote. So there's nothing wrong with community values and community systems of production and distribution and property, in Carl Hess's view, as long as it's not coercive, as long as no one's forcing you to be a part of and contribute to a community, as long as you're doing it voluntarily. Perhaps not surprising in light of these sorts of statements and his lifestyle at the time, in the early 80s, Carl Hess edited a self-sufficiency newsletter called Survival Tomorrow. So, you know, he really was a part of this movement that combined self-sufficiency with survivalism. And in this, along with his statements about his economic views, as well as his lifestyle from the time he moved to West Virginia, and in some ways even when he was trying to run aquaculture co-ops in D.C., Hess was a pioneer of the modern localist/prepper/survivalist/permaculture/whatever other label you want to throw on it movement that has really grown so much in the last 5 or 10 years. In the early 1990s, Carl Hess began to experience severe heart issues. I think he actually had some sort of congenital heart defect that caused him to have heart attacks and things like this. He underwent a heart transplant, but it only extended his life, I think, by another year or two, and he ended up dying of heart problems in 1994. Brian Doherty, in Radicals for Capitalism, writes that Hess's last 2 or 3 decades were characterized by a more pragmatic rather than ideological libertarianism. And he quotes Hess's own words on this subject. Quote, "What really changes our world and the way we live in it are devices and innovations. If you want to know what is happening in a society at any point, look at the tools, not the rhetoric, not the books, not the philosophy. If a tool is available, you can bet somebody is going to use it. And if it works well, you can be certain the world will never be the same again. The free market, for example, is such a tool. Wherever there is unfettered commerce, ordinary people thrive." End quote. Well, there's love of tools and technology. One can only speculate how much Carl Hess would be inspired and delighted by things that have come about since his death, including, just to name a few, the internet in its modern form and things derived from it, ranging from iPhones to all sorts of other things, including podcasts. I mean, think about this. The ability of a regular person like me to basically have my own radio show, and in some ways it's more powerful than a radio show, for a very modest upfront investment, without having to go through the corporate gatekeepers or the FCC or anything like that, this is really a radical thing. It's a radical change in the way people can communicate. And of course, a podcast is just only, you know, one example. Self-publishing, whether in physical form or ebook form, is another example. YouTube would be another example. I mean, all these things have great potential for liberation, and we've only begun to glimpse the implications of these for the long term. Now, on the subject of tools, by the way, one class of tools for which Carl had a particular affinity throughout his life, and one that's coincidentally also near and dear to my own heart, are guns. On the subject of guns, Hess wrote, "Guns and I have been close friends all my life. Guns were special. For me, they combined the beauty of machinery and the romanticism of American history." End quote. Now, on the link between guns and liberty, which Hess definitely saw, he wrote, quote, "Freedom is never thought into existence. It is fought into existence. And that is the way it is kept, by men with the arms to protect the prize. The question of freedom, therefore, when stripped to its steel center, is just this. Who has the guns? There is nothing exclusive about the idea of freedom. Presumably, it can arise anywhere, anytime. But it runs into the grim question, who has the guns? If everyone has them, then a ballot becomes not only possible, but inevitable. If only a few have them, a dictatorship becomes as tempting as inexorable. So when the intellectuals speak glibly of the nature of American freedom, which they transform into a docile, unprotected thing, it might be wise to recall what really happened when that freedom was born. It was not born amid dignified debates and ivory tower proceedings. Dr. William Gordon has recorded how it began at Bunker Hill. The colonists, he reported, were poorly armed, but, he went on in explaining their victory, they were almost all marksmen. That's how it began. That's how it can continue and prevail. End quote. Hear, hear. Brian Doherty in Radicals for Capitalism writes that Hess was, quote, more important ultimately for his image and actions as an activist and public figure than for contributions as a thinker or philosopher. He was vital to the nascent libertarian movement's growth, to an actual, though still small, mass movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and not just because his charisma and style were perfectly suited to the anti-authoritarian and anti-status quo spirit of that time. The way he thought, wrote, and comported himself attracted a different type of devotee than did other libertarian thinkers, influences, or institutions. Carl was not merely smart. In the context of the student revolution, against not just the state, but against the whole repressive style of life that the young thought staid, uptight American death culture represented, Carl was hip. The bow-tie-wearing college professor Rothbard, or the student rebellion cursing Russian novelist Ayn Rand, or the Newsweek columnist Milton Friedman calmly and squarely talking economic sense weren't quite. Doherty does think that Hess made a substantive contribution, in addition to just his charismatic style and hipness contributions, to the freedom movement in his, quote, emphasis on the vital importance of individuals and small communities doing things for themselves so that they need not depend on a faraway central government to do things for them. This emphasis on local, decentralized community as a bulwark of liberty and supporter of individual self-sufficiency through local community self-sufficiency. This is something lacking in a lot of other libertarians, at least back then. I don't know, maybe it's on the rise today, somewhat. And there's this whole notion of tools and actually making stuff and technology, this overall DIY ethic. I mean, this is a guy who built his own home into the side of a hill. This is a guy who, after a successful career in journalism and writing for politicians, quit it all to become a welder, right? This is a DIY guy. And this DIY ethic and aesthetic, which you find is just woven throughout Carl's life story, going back to when he was a little kid and his mom taught him and encouraged him to find his own answers to his own questions, this is particularly inspiring to me. It's why I love things like punk rock and garage bands. It's why I love podcasts, because most of them, including a lot of the successful ones, are like mine. They're kind of done on the cheap. They're not the greatest quality. This podcast, obviously, is DIY top to bottom, if you can't tell. And it's based on my heartfelt belief that, first of all, the depth of content and integrity are more important than superficial aesthetic slickness. And also that, given depth of content and integrity, a degree of unslickness, within reason, of course, is actually kind of charming and kind of cool. I personally would rather see a really passionate and fairly skilled garage band than a super slick, virtuoso, but soulless, canned corporate band any day of the week. And I feel the same about things like podcasts, that I'd rather listen to podcasts made by quote-unquote regular people, but who are passionate and honest and have integrity, than listen to some slick corporate thing cranked out by a radio station or anywhere else. Now, in addition to the DIY factor, ideological overlap, and all these sorts of things, I also appreciate Carl Hess in terms of his life story and him as a model, because he was three overlapping things that I personally aspire to be. Number one, he was what's called an autodidact. And if you don't know that word, an autodidact is someone who, with some help and guidance where necessary, is able to teach himself things. And that's always been something I've been into. Thing number two, Carl Hess was a polymath. That's a man who is knowledgeable and or masterful in multiple fields. It's another thing I appreciate and respect and that I aspire to be. And the third thing, which is sort of like a polymath, but a more particular type of polymath, I believe Carl Hess was a Renaissance man. something that I very much respect, admire, and try to emulate. Not just him, but all the other great Renaissance men I know of through history, not all of whom are from the Renaissance. And this is why, in the intro to the podcast, it makes the reference to a Renaissance man for the new dark age. Whether or not I am, that's what I aspire to be. I think we're on potentially the cusp of a new dark age now, and we need more Renaissance men and women to try and keep the fires, of creativity and integrity and intelligence and so on alive in the face of a dark age. Now, Renaissance man, where I think that's different than just a pure polymath is just someone who's masterful and or knowledgeable in a variety of subjects. A Renaissance man, what I think distinguishes it from a polymath is the added dimension that, in the case of a Renaissance man, there's a clear balance between physical skill, intellectual depth, and creativity. In other words, I think a true Renaissance man is, when you look at, you know, the various areas in which he's a master, they're spread across those three categories. Physical skills, knowing how to do stuff, how to make stuff, whatever. Intellectual depth, being literate, being an intelligent thinker. And then creativity. And that these three things each reinforce the other. And the more you can pursue them in a balanced fashion, the better of a person you'll ultimately be, the more, you know, well-rounded. And I think Carl Hess is a good example of a Renaissance man when you look at all the things. I mean, he was a masterful, successful writer. He was a welder. He was a hunter, a fisherman, a shooter. He built stuff. He designed things. He was a thinker. You know, go on and on and on. Just think back to that opening statement I read you from the start of the Wikipedia article about this guy. So anyway, the autodidact, the polymath, and the Renaissance man are all ideals that I personally strive for, and I hope that you do, or that you will, as well. Now, I could go on for probably another hour or two about Carl Hess, but I think this is plenty long enough for a podcast episode. I think it should be obvious why, though I certainly don't consider that he was perfect or that he was correct about everything. But on the whole, I would consider Carl Hess a personal hero in the sense of a guy that there's many aspects of his life that are inspiring and so on. And this is why I chose him as our very first Dangerous History Podcast hero. So I hope you've been entertained, intrigued, and inspired by this podcast. Next time, I'll be talking about a group that, for the most part, I dearly love. To hate, that is. And I'm talking about American progressives, specifically the original late 19th / early 20th century progressives. Remember, if you like my Dangerous History podcast, please help spread the word to others, grow the audience. After all, this is a bottom-up, DIY, guerrilla anarchist history show in the best Hessian, Carl Hessian tradition. So, thank you for listening to my Dangerous History podcast. Remember, feel free to post comments or to email me at profcj@profcj.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.